Thank you, Ben. That was hella cool. We also learned, I think, that there was a secret message in there that was a call to arms for all social scientists, that in the language wars between the humanities and the social scientists, the humanities are clearly taking over the word grimace, and that we need to then, you know, fight back by using the word grimace more. It's a great word, and we should not give it over to those damn humanities professors. But no, seriously, that was great. And now I'm going to introduce our discussants. We didn't. It is a testament to the expertise and talent in the New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology section that we did not have to go far to select our discussants for tonight. They are Rudy Gaudio and Melissa Checker. First, I'll introduce Rudy. In addition to being co-chair of the New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology section, a job he has to do with me, which is the theme here, that both of them have to work with me a lot, and they manage to accomplish things anyway. Rudy is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Media Studies at Purchase College at SUNY. A Stanford University-trained linguist, his primary field site is urban Nigeria, where he has established for himself quite a profile of fieldwork expertise and excellence. His first phase of fieldwork was in Kano, and it culminated in the groundbreaking book Allah Made Us, Sexual Outlaws in an Islamic African City, which was published by Blackwell Press in 2009. This book received the Ruth Benedict Prize from the Association of Queer Anthropologists. With support from the New York National Science Foundation and the Winogrand Foundation, he is now engaged in a new project on language creolization, I think. Is that right? Language shift? Language change? Whatever. Something. In Abuja, Nigeria's capital city. He's already proven his mettle tonight in identifying Maltese as the language Ben selected arbitrarily in his talk. Let's see what else he has to say. Please don't grimace and join me in welcoming our co-chair, Rudy Gaudio.
You're good at these introductions. Thank you very much. Ben, thank you. I want to say that Melissa and I touched base about the idea of having two discussants, and the reason we did it is because we've got, like, the linguistic anthro angle and the public anthro angle, but we realized that, you know, it's getting late, and so we're going to keep our comments short. We've both made that agreement. I just want to say that it's thrilling to have Ben here, and it's thrilling to have you in the public sphere, to have, like, a trained linguistic anthropologist speaking on language, and I loved Bill Sapphire's column for all those years, and I've loved a lot of other writings by people who are not trained linguists or linguistic anthropologists, but it's really great to read what Ben writes, where he's kind of speaking either implicitly or explicitly to the research that people that we know are doing. And so it's just nice to have that integration. And there's very few people achieve it. And my hat is off to you for having done that and continuing to do it. And I'm thrilled about it. So I just have a few kind of thought points that come up from the talk that Ben gave tonight, which are just meant to be just things I'm thinking of based on what you were saying. That kind of fascinated me. And one was the degree when you were talking about like this machines thinking and all of that. And I was thinking back to like earlier versions of this, like Deep Blue in the 90s, IBM's chess playing computer, which seemed to challenge human intelligence, but how Watson does it even more because Watson speaks and understands language and Siri does the same thing. And it seems this is a really interesting move within this whole like cyborg idea where language again kind of surfaces as the iconic feature of humanity. And now, given the way the technology has evolved, it's almost like this ideology of language as being like the thing that makes us human can resurface. And I should say that I'm a linguist who doesn't necessarily believe it. Like, I don't believe that language is the only thing that makes us human. But it really is interesting that some of the discourses that emerge and some of the examples that emerge kind of reinforce that ideology. I question it, and I think that you're questioning it too in a certain way. And I welcome that. It was really fascinating. It makes me want to look more at the stuff that's going to be coming out as the technology improves and as the humanness of these machines becomes even closer to ours, or it seems to. that led me to thinking about like the age-old thing in linguistic anthropology between language and reality, or language and thought, but especially like language and sociocultural reality, the kind of Sapir-Whorfian thing, and the way in which your critique seemed to be, you didn't label that, but it seemed to me that you were saying that a lot of the ways in which this data-driven language study is going is assuming that language simply reflects the social reality, which as linguistic anthropologists and sociolinguists, we've been kind of arguing against that for a long time, not because we're old-fashioned Whorfians who believe that some grammatical structure in our brains predetermines how we think, but because the way we use language, or what Sapir called the linguistic habits, kind of shape our understandings of reality. And so I appreciated your shout out to Penny Eckert and the communities of practice. Penny Eckert was on my dissertation committee, so I have a particular fondness for that. But a lot of the people that I know who were trained by her in my era and subsequently who were working in this area are looking at, as you put it, language as a resource for the creation for the projection and creation of social identities and social realities. So I appreciate, once again, your kind of using the sociolinguistic and linguistic and anthropological research to kind of critique what's going on in what seems to be a largely industrial setting of research to add the nuances that come from the scholarly appreciation. It made me interested also to think about applications for this, both from a scholarly point of view and from a kind of political discourse point of view, regarding critical discourse analysis, which tends to be a more like European, other side of the pond kind of study about like rhetorical propagandistic uses of languages. You have language, it seems to me that the quantitative approach could be very interesting and productive for those folks. They tend to use very qualitative methods, but a quantitative method could enhance that. And I believe some might be doing this. I may be just ignorant of it, but it seemed promising. It also made me think about ways in which political marketers, as you said, political marketers and other marketers, as I think what you said, might want to use this research. And that led me to my last point or question, which is the degree to which what you call the kind of commodification of language seems to be generating a commercialization of linguistic research. And having been trained in linguistics in Silicon Valley, it was already pretty clear in the early 90s the degree to which linguists could get money for doing research that was marketable, industrially useful, although I think many linguists were kind of selling the research they were doing as marketable in ways that were not immediately marketable, and hats off to them for getting that, like Hewlett-Packard money and IBM money and Xerox money and Apple money, and it's going. There's a lot of money for this in Silicon Valley, so it's no coincidence that a lot of this literature comes from, a lot of the research comes from that area. But it makes me wonder about it. It makes me wonder about the way that the research goes, if it's being funded by these large corporations. And just in your talk, you talked about IBM, iPhone, Google, Twitter. These are these mega corporations that are funding the research. And I'm not necessarily a conspiracy theorist, but it just makes me wonder about like the shape of in terms of a meta thought about the way linguistic research goes when all this money is going into it. What is the shape of the research? And once again, I appreciate your kind of gentle cautionary points about the reasons to kind of question the premises, both intellectual and, I might add, political and commercial, for the kinds of data that are being generated and the kinds of analyses that are coming out of it. So those are my questions. And I look forward to the questions you're all going to have after Melissa talks. So Jeff, you can introduce Melissa. Thank you.
So do you think that Mark Zuckerberg is guilty? No. In addition to being a member of the New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology section, Melissa Checker, our next discussant, is Associate Professor of Urban Studies at Queens College and of Anthropology and Environmental Psychology at the Graduate Center at CUNY. There is only one other professor in the entire CUNY system with the same combination of affiliations, and that's me. So once again, one of Melissa's minor accomplishments is overcoming the daily obstacle of seeing me in all three locations where she works. you guys are fine. Her research and writing focus on race, poverty, and environmental justice in the United States, and she is the author of the award-winning Polluted Promises, Environmental Racism in the Search for Justice in a Southern Town, which is published by New York University Press in 2007 and won the Association for Humanist Sociology Book Award in the same year.
Melissa is also outgoing co-editor of the Public Anthropology Review section of the American Anthropologist, and it is in that capacity that I imagine she has encountered big data in full force. She has also distinguished herself as a public anthropologist in her own right. For example, her work, she has written on environmental gentrification, global warming, and other issues for the Gotham Gazette and for other magazines. In all of her work, she has been swimming in a sea of data, and it reminds me of the fact that Melissa and I currently have to deal with the fact that Melissa produced these excellent websites for our undergraduate students and now have the problem of no one to maintain them, so which is another flip side of the data problem. So given that experience with big data and her public anthropology experience, I'm very curious to see what Melissa has to say tonight. Please welcome her.
Thanks. I'm going to keep my remarks pretty short since the hour is late and we do want to have time for discussion. I thought that there were many provocative points that were raised for me, at least in this talk. And I think I do want to also say how heartening it is to see how much in demand Ben is, which, of course, is mostly a testament to his own personal talents. But also, to take a step back, it's good to see that there's a kind of hunger, desire to put some of these technologies into context and to look at the nuances of language and of our digital presence. So I think what I'm going to do is kind of focus my comments more on questions that were raised for me by this talk and some of the implications for some of these modes of research for, which I would say are kind of like a digital archaeology of the present, and that's what kept coming to mind. The image was this kind of tools for sort of digging into our present lives through some of this data, but I think it also raises a lot of questions about the kind of methods that we're using when we do gather data from online sources and some of the areas where I think maybe anthropologists could contribute. So one thing that sort of came to mind first, and this is kind of just something I'm throwing out there, is and I'm sure somebody out there is doing research and or this is coming up in various contexts, but this kind of channel switching between analog and digital meets. So I thought of that because I wrote my notes in longhand and also on my tablet, and I have no idea why I wrote on both or for what made me want to switch from one to the other. I thought that was sort of an interesting question. But I think more sort of more to the theme of maybe the public implications of our work and also the methods of cultural anthropologists, those of us who aren't necessarily linguistic anthropologists, but certainly technology, online technology has changed the way that we collect data dramatically. And I think definitely there are lots of pros, and then there are also some unforeseen implications of that. So, for example, in my own work now, which is with activists in New York City, I collect data from emails, texts, comments on various websites, online forum, listservs, Facebook. So I'm kind of pulling data from all of those sources, but I'm not always necessarily so thoughtful about the data that I'm taking and how I'm reproducing it. And so, for example, if I'm getting an email from somebody who's got me on a list with 50 other people, I've been sort of considering that as public domain, which means that I can then use it as I wish. But, you know, is it really public domain if I'm on a list with 50 people? But what if those 50 people, what if they, you know, half of them send forward on that email to another 50 people? Then it sort of does become public. And so none of these kinds of things are really raised or addressed, I guess, in IRBs, as problematic as they are for other reasons. But these are kinds of things that I'm not sure we're really systematically thinking through. And that perhaps we should be, because even if we make our informants anonymous when we're reproducing some of the the sentences that they create in these online forums, it's wouldn't be that hard necessarily to identify them. So you can easily Google a sentence, for example, and find it in a forum. Even if that forum is closed to the public, it often these things come up. Same thing with Facebook. It's kind of hit and miss whether things appear. And so I think that that's something that maybe is going to require some more ethical consideration for anthropologists. And of course, there's a lot to be gained from collecting data in this way. I mean, personally, I feel like I can collect much more data than ever, just sitting at my desk without actually having to go anywhere, which is fantastic, but also is a little bit, you wonder what's being missed, right, when you're not actually there. And writing up your field notes at the end of the day, I would say I've certainly gotten a little bit lazier about writing things up very carefully, because I feel like, well, I'm getting so much from so many different sources that I feel like I can kind of cover some of the holes. And then, of course, there are also questions that people are addressing, I think, about whether it's ethical to go online to, say, do research in an online forum, representing yourself as something other than what you are. And then there are these kind of personal questions that I think anthropologists could talk about maybe among each other, but not necessarily so much publicly. For example, do you friend your informants on Facebook? Do you allow your students to friend informants on Facebook? You know, do you give your students guidelines about doing that? Should you? And how do you kind of, you know, what kinds of boundaries do you want to set up, or how can you, or is it even possible to set up some of those boundaries? So, for example, do I really want the people I know in the field to see photos of me when I was 16, you know, going to a prom or something, you know? But these are all kinds of things that I think are sort of considerations that have always been there, but are obviously in these new forms now, which deserve some attention. And I think, let me see if I have any other things I wanted to address. I think actually I've kind of turned it over to you and hear what you all have to say about the issues that have been raised this evening. Thank you.
Either way, it's nice. I don't understand, moralistically speaking, what kind of statistics you use, because analyzing email of Zuckerberg to Judge Scalia, it's about 100 pieces or something. And of course, you can use statistics to so small set. You can use statistics to find some frequency of words in million books, but what gives you four? You can, if you analyze a million of songs, you can write a bestseller hit of song from this analyze? Of course not. And the same idea is about analyzing a million books. You can do this for books too. This is only, I don't know how is the culturonomic from frequency of words, because everybody knows the most popular word in New York is F word. This is my example. Yeah. And of course, in your book will be cream, greens. Yeah. And whole idea that statistic is many times is used is misleading, like bullet fingerprints. It was used totally wrong 50 years. Yeah. I found that this is misunderstanding of statistics. Because you can't say that Oswald was guilty in 45% or somebody, and this was FBI from headquarters of Tampico is doing a proof like this. It means about 50,000 of innocent people is in American prison. Because we
yeah. Is there a question?
This is well.
I'm not sure what the question was, but I think that the concerns that you're raising are valid in terms of the question of statistical significance on small bodies of texts, but also in the case of even the largest corpus one can construct, for instance, from Google Books, trying to determine what is significant and what's not. And these, we're really at the early stages of a lot of this type of research, and these are exactly the types of problems that researchers are going to need to confront, whether they're dealing with very small collections of texts or very large ones, exactly, you know, how to understand what is statistically significant in those. So other questions?
Well, I have a comment. There's a very interesting paper. It's interesting to see all the ways in which supposedly linguistic data is being analyzed largely by commercial firms. Largely commercial firms. But in fact, what it seems to be doing is completely eliminating any interest in spoken language. Because spoken language doesn't come to you already written.
Right.
And therefore, you don't have easy access to it. And in fact, everything that's interesting about human beings and how they use language is there in spoken language.
Right. That's an excellent point, and I think in my presentation I favored analysis of written text, but that is where most of the emphasis is these days for obvious reasons. We have more forms of written language data from online sources and so forth than we ever have before. That's not to slight the importance of the development of spoken language corpora, which is going on in very interesting ways. For instance, the Linguistic Data Consortium at University of Pennsylvania building up various spoken corpora from everything from collections of telephone conversations that have been recorded. There are telephone corpora that researchers have, and also the work that Jamie Pennebaker does at the University of Texas very often relies on transcriptions of spoken text. There is, I think, this disposition in terms of the research that goes on now to favor the written text because it's so readily available. But it's also interesting to note that even when we're talking about written versus spoken, there are so many different styles, registers, genres that we find now in a case like Twitter, where very often, I was giving examples of pronunciation spellings where it's written, but it may have certain kinships with spoken interaction, not just on the level of how you're spelling a word, which might say something about how you're pronouncing it, but the kind of conversational flow that happens in those situations, or with instant messaging and other cases of short messaging back and forth, which may very often have some similarities, and for the participants themselves seems to be based on a model of speech that is being transferred or transposed in interesting ways to these types of short texts. So it's an excellent point, and one that definitely. Yeah.
Well, and also all the Twitter-like comments, mm-hmm. you lose all the socioeconomic, cultural information that's there in the actual interaction, or that's known between the two interactors. If all you have is the Twitter.
Yes, right. There's this high level of abstraction that's going on in many cases where all of that is wiped away. There are possibilities for taking those texts and then perhaps trying to identify the user and where you actually are getting some more sort of, say, socioeconomic information, or even knowing the gender of someone may be difficult to establish. But what I talked about with the Twitter research, very often the information that we know about the user is at least geographical, but even that is complicated in terms of knowing, well, is, you know, the person at that place, where did they grow up? All of the things that would come out in a questionnaire or survey type form in linguistic fieldwork, which instead, again, the research happens on this high level of abstraction, where we will still need the careful fieldwork that goes on that establishes these things and talks about social roles. But I'm interested in the way that perhaps that ethnographic type of study or other types of fieldwork can actually go hand in hand with these data-driven methods. And I think there's a lot of potential there, I think.
I just wanted to follow up on that question about corporate from spoken English. And Google had an application called Google 411 that they ran for a long time. It was very, very popular among users, and that they mysteriously shut off after about 2 years or so. And it emerged that, in fact, while they were providing this 411 type service to their users for free, actually what they were doing was they were accumulating tremendous amounts of spoken English for their own analytical purposes, which they're now folding into other research projects. So it's happening on the corporate side as well.
Right, and companies like Google are interested indeed in trying to have this sort of digital anthropology that one can conduct again very often for the purposes of understanding, say in Google's case, how people search for things online and how that may be monetized in various ways. And it does also get to the issues that Melissa was raising of the sort of the fraught public versus private distinction with much of this interaction where people might not know, for instance, that what they're saying or what the way that they're interacting online is actually feeding into some research project and about this type of interaction. And of course, with Facebook and Twitter and social media and younger people often having very different ideas about that fuzzy boundary between public and private, the sharing of so much information again is useful from being able to collect data on people and linguistic data and other types of data, but raises plenty of privacy concerns that we have to keep in mind, even if the companies that are using this data are not always so careful with it.
I just want to thank you again for your talk. That was fascinating. I want to follow up on some of Rudy's comments about where I think he's trying to get at this a sense of language ideologies of these new language detectives, right, who are collecting corpuses and doing statistical analyses. I guess my question to you would be, if you were to do a language ideology study of the kinds of language studies that are being done now, what would be the view of language as a type of social practice? So it's not just in terms of the distinction between spoken and written language. Obviously, there are ideologies about that. They're implicit in terms of thinking about language as a kind of naturalistic or kind of spontaneous type of practice. But also, what are the models of interaction and how are those being conceived in relationship to the way in which language is coding for culture and this kind of culturomics, right? And then some of the sociopsychology work. I guess what's your general view of language? And it's not just in terms of the metalinguistic awareness of words versus these kinds of referential units versus the pronouns, the functional pronouns, but in terms of language as a type of cultural practice.
That's an excellent question. I mean, it makes me think of some of the points that that Rudy brought up about the basic assumptions, the tacit assumptions that are being made in much of this. If we look at sentiment analysis, for instance, that by counting words, one can have a kind of insight into psychological states, emotions, and so forth, which takes a naive view of both emotions and language on both sides of the equation. And certainly we can see a kind of a language ideology at play in terms of the understanding of language as a simple reflection of deeper states, but also even just dealing with language, the focus on the element of the word as well. I mean, it's something that that I find again and again as a kind of you could call it a lexicocentric language ideology, which is an ideology that matters a lot to me since I'm often writing about words and their history and sort of treating them as the basic unit of study. But of course, you know, we lose so much of that's you know possible to talk about that does not necessarily rise to the level of metalinguistic awareness. And so words then become these units that are available to physicists to talk about. And the example that I gave just recently, the idea that physicists are now publishing papers in scientific journals about linguistic history might seem a little odd, but because they now have this data set and they figure that data set is just as good as any other data set that they can analyze, then that's dealing with some kind of ideology of how language works, which seems to have a kind of a physics-based model. As I described, it seemed to be a particle model, and perhaps there are wave models as well. I think that what's happening is what might have previously been the purview of linguists is now becoming open and available to people in all sorts of disciplines who might not be thinking about issues of, you know, what are those tacit assumptions that they're making about the way that language works in the world? What can you say about things like the social construction of identity rather than just simply assuming identities are fixed in some way in these online spaces, which very often are very fluid in terms of the building of an online persona through all the discursive resources that are available. So I mean, that's where I see the role of the young researchers, the grad students who care about these things, who are reading about language ideology and so forth, and then also, you know, taking in all of this data that's now available and thinking about them in sort of careful ways and critical ways. I think that's where my hopes lie, where my optimism is.
I think it's important to keep in mind, in kind of a twist of the observer's paradox, the tool that we're using, the online tool, whether it's Twitter or Facebook, more than just reflecting what's going on in real life language, it's also affecting language.
Yes.
So there's kind of this multiple levels going on where we have word, like even on the word level, if you want to go to that like abstract notion, just abstraction of words, the whole system of how words, the whole internet meme idea is kind of an internet-driven internal thing that we don't actually know what we're observing sometimes, whether it's a trend for certain sentimental words on Twitter that's being spread on Twitter because people are reading other people's tweets and picking up on some of those things. I just thought that was something that we needed to
do. Oh, I agree completely. And you know, my focus in this talk has been really just on what people are doing with language as an object of analysis. But the production of language in all of these new online forms is fascinating to me and one that I continue to look at understanding how, as you say, the same tools that we now use for collecting all of this data are being used by people themselves for the circulation of you know, new forms of language, of new understandings of the way language should work, the self-presentation. Exactly. So in my ongoing work and the project that all of this is a part of, I definitely want to consider those things. Thank you.
It's nearly 9 o'clock, which is amazing. You kept us very stimulated. I want to thank you again, Ben.
So as Jeff mentioned, this is our last event for the year. We'll be back in September, so stay tuned for... big thanks to our hosts here at Brenner Gren, who stay late on their Monday nights to help us do this. Thank you.